I want to try and keep this a little chronological, so we're going to get to that. Let's see if there's... Now, before we leave the subject of clarinet players, the name Artie Shaw.
Oh, yeah.
Ring a bell with you?
You see, Artie Shaw, there's no question that this was tried on me in the Fairmont Hotel. Benny Goodman was sitting to my right, and Herb Cain was sitting to my left. And Herb Cain said, "Well, how about it, Vince? Who was the best of the two clarinet players?" So I turned my face and said, "Well, you know, Benny Goodman." I said, "Benny Goodman is the best of the two clarinet players." But I said, "We mustn't forget that Artie Shaw is a brilliant musician." I told John Markham that, and Markham said, "How lucky were you that you were that you said something so beautiful, you know." Artie Shaw is a brilliant musician, and his last batch of records, though they seem to me that, you know, he was demonstrating his ability to look at a piece of music in 1954 or an arrangement. This was clarinet. I don't know if you heard these, clarinet, bass, piano, drums, guitar vibes, and himself. And it appears as though, to me, it sounds like he really had it down to prove to you that he could get it down. But the previous Artie Shaws were just, he could have gotten music out of a shoehorn. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
The clarinet was just... you know, what he was a 20-year-old kid, but a kid wasn't 20 years old in 1933. He was hungry for a meal, and he played his alto saxophone wherever he could scrape up $100 for the day, because they made in those days, they could make as much as $100 a day playing radio shows and backing up unknowns wherever they could get a record date. They got paid $50 for four sides.
Yeah, that would have been big-time money in those days.
No income tax, not even any Social Security, because the Social Security Act, as I've heard, came in 1936, 37. So he was doing that until finally, I guess, he had to whip this clarinet, whatever it took. You know, he couldn't get up and lead a band with a saxophone. You know, that's my opinion. So he started playing all this, you know, crazy, beautiful music on a clarinet. Like I say, he could have played it on a shoehorn, you know. I mean, he also arranged, part of these records in those days were 3 minutes or less, and you started the arrangement full band, and then you had maybe 8 bars clarinet, tailor-made, and now you full band again, then 16 bars for the saxophones to play their thing, and then maybe 8 bars trumpet, and then the clarinet wailing, and the whole band out, you know. And he arranged, there's a big record of Rose Room. He arranged the saxophone chorus. Practically, if you ask him, I called him several times, you can talk to him. Mm-hmm. His number's in the book in Newbury Park. I hope you didn't get hurt during that bad earthquake, but he'll talk to you about 5 minutes. Oh, yeah. Beautiful man. Oh, yeah.
Wow. Now, there was another instance where Herb Cain, you were chatting with Herb Cain about Benny Goodman, and... Did Herb arrange for you two to play together or something?
What happened was that in 1972, I told my wife, I said, we were married about 4 years then. I said, and my wife is very frugal. And I said, come on. I said, we're going to go to New York City to take a lesson from Benny Goodman. I said, we'll pay him $200. And she said, okay. So I called Herb Cain. I've known Herb Cain since 1940, before I even got out of school. I said, I want to go to New York, and I'm going to take a lesson from Benny Goodman, find out how much it's going to cost. And I said, and make sure he's there the day that he tells you, because you never know what Benny Goodman's going to do from 1 minute to the next. So he understood that. So he called me back in an hour, and he said, you're going to leave on such and such a day. You're going to be at his house in such and such an hour, and he'll give you a 2-hour lesson free.
Wow.
So we got... That was, you know, so I took the lesson, you know.
So what was your feeling about that?
Pardon me?
What was your feeling about that?
What was my feeling about it?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I wasn't excited because I thought I'm going to save a couple of $100. That was the first thing
that was the biggest thrill of it?
That's the first thing that came to my mind. I wasn't so, you know, that thrilled. I knew what I was going to do with them once I got in his house because I put everything in Braille, you see.
So how did that go when you met him?
Pardon me?
How did it go when you met him?
Oh, it was perfect until, you know, you have to leave the secretary. Benny so-and-so is on the phone. Bobby Rosengarten is on the phone. That's that drummer that had a band. He backed up Dick Cavett. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he knew Benny real well. And so as soon as that phone call came, I was gone. It was about an hour and maybe 45 minutes. But he played the clarinet. I played the clarinet. And we both played the clarinet together. And that was about it. And you see, the way you do it, you don't ask a question and then tell him another answer. Mm-hmm. I speeded things up by saying, why this and what is that? And I never questioned his answers. Mm-hmm. See, because the minute you question an answer, you've blown your stack, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. He's not gonna have you question what he's telling you. Mm-hmm. So in the end, he said, you've been very good. And that's about, you know, because I'm sure that other clarinet players of his ilk, almost his ilk, have tried to go toe-to-toe with him, you know. And you can't go toe-to-toe with somebody who's played the clarinet for so many years, who has taken so many lessons from so many people, you know, that they're, you know, the poor man, by the time he had that heart attack in his house, June 13th of 1986, it was a Friday, just in case you both don't know. You know, there isn't much you can do with, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Were there some other famous clarinet players that you had a chance to perform with?
Well, when we were down in... Dave, are you not getting tired?
No, huh?
Okay, sir. When we were down in Los Angeles, the place to go to at that time in April, May, June, July, well, it went into August. It went into 1946. But while I was there, they had jam session night. So I got up and played opposite Bonnie Brugard.
Oh, boy.
And that's the first time I ever felt what they call an Albert System clarinet.
Yes.
My clarinets have 17 keys and 6 rings. Uh-huh. These, when they plain Albert, I think only have about 11 keys and 5 rings. But see, my clarinet has alternates. There's no alternates on an Albert system. Either you do it from this side, my right hand I'm wiggling with the rollers, or you do it with the little finger of the left hand with rollers. But the clarinet, the BAM system, 17 plain BAM system clarinet, you can play in the left hand, and you can also play it in the right hand. Right, Harvey?
That's right.
Okay.
So you can achieve the same notes with several different fingerings.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Both little fingers on a will get the same notes on a BAM system, but on an Albert, one finger will get the note. You don't play it from, I'm wiggling my little fingers. You don't get them from both little fingers.
So now, was Brugard playing Albert? And so you wanted to play Albert to go along with what he was doing, or you didn't have your, I'm curious why you were playing Albert system with him.
Maybe I said it wrong. I played my BAM system.
Oh, and he played Albert.
And he played Albert.
Mm-hmm. How did that work together? Do those systems
as I recall, it was satisfactory. You know, he played. I mean, look, I was playing with, the cream of the crop.
Absolutely.
Alan Eager. I don't know where he is now. Played tenor saxophone, bebop tenor saxophone. We were all up there. Chuck Travis was up there with his saxophone. We all got a chance to play. Everybody and the man that ran these jam sessions was Slim Gaylord.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah. Slim and Bam were there doing their shtick, and they'd let us come up and play. And let's see, that's one clarinet player. Now we go back. Now we're going to jump again to the Monterey Jazz Festival, 1958. I played in the Monterey Jazz Festival of 1958. Do you want to hear this story?
Please.
Well. Peanuts Hucko was playing with Louis Armstrong, and I guess it was I don't know if it was Trummy Young or Jack Tigon. I don't remember. But after our performances this particular night, we went to a nightclub, and we proceeded to jam. And I just blew Peanuts out of the room. You know, this is a hell of a thing for me to say. So from then on, we kept on. We went to a private party in a great big hall. Now we're at 3 o'clock in the morning. Marty Marsala, you know, the trumpet player. That's a record that was made previous to that, called Jazz at the San Francisco Waterfront on ABC Paramount. It was made in the high school in Carmel, the same high school that they recorded Earl Garner's something by Concert by the Sea.
Do you have a tape or a copy of that LP?
Dave, this was on kind of short notice, and we've been working on our income tax.
I might be able to dig one up, actually.
But I think you can get that. Somebody's got, Mal Sharpe's got a record of it because he's played it. But I want to say, we got to this private party 3 o'clock, and within two tunes, he just put me away. He became so strong. We're still talking about Peanuts.
Uh-huh.
He became so strong, so Benny Goodman-ish. You know, Peanuts has led Benny Goodman bands since Benny's died. He's gone on tour. Uh-huh. He's a great clarinet player. But in the earlier part of the night, I knew I had him. But, oh, man, he just became so potent, so powerful that I just felt my way and just stepped off the stand, blind man style, and his wife grabbed me, his wife Pinky at the time, and pulled me away. And I said, I've had it. He was still playing when I got off the bandstand.
How did you get hooked up with Marty Marsala?
Well, boy, well, I'll tell you what, how long have we been talking?
An hour.
But, you know, it's kind of interesting because these things haven't ran too long. The editing will be crazy. What happened was that Jimmy Lyons did this Concert by the Sea with Earl Garner, and then he told Marty Marsala, get your group together. I want to do a concert with you guys down in Carmel. And in conjunction with Bert Bales, mm-hmm. the piano player, and Bert said, well, I want my clarinet player. Well, Marty Marsala said, I want my clarinet player. And so...
Who was Bales and who was Marsala's at the time?
Bert Bales, you know that he was...
You said my clarinetist. Who was his clarinetist at the time?
I was his clarinet. I'm
okay.
And I was his clarinet. He wanted to use me because I played a lot of, by that time, a lot of trios uh-huh. with Bert. And I played after hours places with Bert. So Marty says, no, I want to use Bobby Stoll.
Uh-huh.
My friend, Bobby Stoll. And Bobby played good, too. But, well, anyway... It ended up that I got to go to Carmel and play this concert, and they recorded it and then released a record, Jazz at the San Francisco on the Jazz on the San Francisco Waterfront, and then they went to a club owner, his name was Lloyd Sanchez, and his partner Mary Sanchez, who owned a place called the Bon Gusto Restaurant, but were interested in calling it the Cupid Doll. And they wanted a Dixieland band. So Marty said, okay, listen to this record. And there is some applause for the clarinet player on this record. And the boss said, that's the band I want. I want that. And Bert says, I'm not going to make it because I'm playing a Pier 23. But that clarinet player's name is Vince Catolica. And Marty said, no, no, no. He said, I want to bring Bobby in. He says, you bring Vince Catolica in or you don't get the job. So help me, that was the truth, you guys.
Wow.
And
so that's how you got to play with what Marsala, was it at the Cupid Doll then?
That's where I got to play with Marty, and boy, every night was just as beautiful as the night before. He was very good. He's a New York player. His brother played a clarinet. Mm-hmm. His brother wrote a song called Don't Cry Joe, and his brother also wrote a song called Slow Down, Why Don't You Slow Down? Well, Frank Sinatra made Don't Cry Joe, and I don't recall any of the records before that. And Gene Krupa made a record of Why Don't You Slow Down. So did Joe Marsala. He was married to Adele Gerard, the harp player. Ever heard of her?
No.
Yeah, that's another series of records, you know. Now, you know, some of this...
I see Marty Marsala's address is listed here in the 1960 Leonard Feather Encyclopedia of Jazz as 654 Bush Street.
Yeah, but didn't mean to laugh so loud. That's right, Dave. Yeah, he worked here. He worked here around, and he was beautiful. Here we go with that title, Dixieland trumpet player. What he actually was a hot trumpet player. Man, he could. I'm too bad for Bobby Stoll. He didn't get to have that. You know, I mean, Bobby had a lot of good jobs, too, but, you know, sometimes other people have to have good jobs. Just like now, I'm out of it, and there's another clarinet player that's playing in this band with Jill Miller, LaVey Smith. His name is Jerry Locus. Is that the name?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Jerry Locus, and we have Jerry Locus, Harvey on saxophone, and Bill Stewart on tenor alto sax, and Larry Light on trombone. And Steven Strauss on bass, and I forget the kid's name on drums.
Dan Foltz
on drums, and Chris Siebert on piano.
Now we've got some of that to listen to.
Yeah, that sounds well. I was in some of that, some of the time, but I decided to stop.
Was there something that you had a lot of fun with on that session? Do you remember anything in particular?
Well, recording sessions really, for me, they're kind of nerve-wracking because I want to get myself established sitting there or standing there, and sometimes they'll stop and listen to a take,
mm-hmm.
you know, whereas we played 5 or 6, 7 takes of My Heart Belongs to Daddy, and I kept my poise, as you say, you know, I was sitting there, and every time I heard the count, I had to play the intro on it.
Mm-hmm.
That came out all right. Well, this is when one of the tunes this young lady sings, but then we did a batch with Chris, and I told Chris, I said, tell the man that's running the equipment that just leave the tape on. If there's a sour mistake, just count it over, and we'll start so that I don't lose my spit that's in my mouth, because everything has to be just right. So when we stopped, they just stop and then count it, and we'd start again. And that felt better to me. That's the only thing I haven't been involved too much, and I'm not haven't been involved at all as a leader mm-hmm. on a recording session.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see. This is Dave Radlauer at KALW with Jazz Rhythm, and my special guest Vince Catalica. Vince, talking about the many years he's been playing jazz, swing, Dixieland music in the California and particularly Northern California area. It's a real pleasure having you here, Vince.
It's a lot of fun being here. I'm just warming up because I got more stories yet.
Okay, well, now you worked many, many years with Jimmy Diamond. Hold on. We've going to get a fresh roll of...
Just to get it... You don't want it to go on too long. We talk about the job at the Fairmont.
Yeah, sure.
And we want to talk about Jill's band,
mm-hmm.
and we want to talk about a little bit about North Beach, but there isn't much I can say about North Beach.
Okay, well, we can talk about that. And then Vukovic, of course.
Vukovic, yeah,
yes.
Right.
Okay. So let's start off now. So you spent many years with Jimmy Diamond.
Yeah, I spent... what we did is after I played that one job, he hired me for different small groups and society jobs, and there was some jazz played. I never had to play any tenor or alto, just clarinet. But what happened was that in 1972, this man by the name of Buddy Powers, he's gone now, young kid. Well, he was a young kid. Yeah. He convinced the owner and manager of the hotel, the Fairmont Hotel, to bring this type of band, 6 pieces, on every Monday night starting in September of that year, 1972. It just took off. It just went bananas. And by December, we were playing there every Monday night.
Is that the New Orleans room?
This is the New Orleans room. And by the first week of December, we were playing there. Union Law then was five nights a week. And we packed the place. It was just a great job.
When you say Union Law, what do you mean? That was the maximum they could work? Or you say Union Law for five nights?
Oh, yeah, that's Union Law.
Meaning they couldn't work you more than five nights?
Oh, you couldn't work in that room more than five nights.
I see.
Boy, you got it. Yeah, you could work two other private parties, but you couldn't play in there just five nights.
Oh, I see.
So anyway, I just wanted to say that we played there. Different things happened, which I will just bypass. But I was the clarinet player there for 10 years. And so I got out of there. The axe fell on different ones, and then it fell on me. It fell on everybody.
Uh-huh.
But that room, I am kind of proud of that because we did pack that room with local and, as you know, tons of tourists.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Then later, you followed Jimmy on to the Hyatt Regency.
Let's put that.
Or is that more of a casual, a little more casual?
Yeah, these were every Saturday afternoon. I played some of those, but also Phil Howe played some of those.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
The reed player.
Okay. This is Dave Radlauer having a conversation with Vince Catalica, who has played clarinet in this area for many, many years. You're listening to Jazz Rhythm on KALW 91.7, your BBC source for Northern California. And we've talked about most of your career. We're up to the 1970s now. And I guess at some point you moved from Dixieland to a more mainstream jazz with Larry Vukovich?
Yeah. That was after leaving the Fairmont, I just fooled around. I began to do one of my Artie Shaw licks. You know, he'd stop too, so I stopped. I didn't play for a year. And then I started playing again with a band called Sweet and Hot. This was Jerry Butson, Ernie Figueroa, Waldo Carter, trumpet player, and John Markham, John Marabuda, and Al Obudinski, and me, and also Herb Stewart. He's the man that played lead tenor on Four Brothers and also plays the last solo, I believe. Anyway, we started playing around. We played Bach Dynamite parties. And then now we're up to about 1990, and then that's when I met up with Larry, started hiring me at the hotel. Larry Vukovich hires all kinds of talent at the Hyatt at Union Square. They call that the Grand Hyatt. And on the 36th floor, it's Club 36. He hires all kinds of people, clarinet players, saxophone players, singers. And he started hiring me around 1989. And then he decided that we should make an album. And we made an album that's out on CD. And we added, it's John Markham, Al Obudinski, Larry Vukovich, and Alan Smith and myself. And it's just, I'm not playing any saxophones. I haven't played a saxophone since, oh God, the early 60s. I just played clarinet on it. And we have a few things like Undecided. I also play a blues, a little blues. And then I play in a blues with the rest of the group. And I play in Perdido. And then the rest of it is involved with Alan Smith and rhythm section. Also, Larry did a few solos by himself, too.
Sounds great. Let's listen to a little bit.
Okay.
Okay. Good. So later we'll insert music there.
Right.
So that brings us right up to the present.
Yeah, I wanted to tell you that this last band I played in, LaVey Smith's band, it really was a lot of fun for me. Because I guess you'd call Chris, the musical director.
Chris Siebert.
Chris Siebert. He said, let's do some Benny Goodman things. So we did quite a few of the sextet things. And we had Harvey Robb playing these sextet things on tenor. And he's now is playing them on clarinet because I'm out. And Bill Stewart plays in this band, alto player. Bill is going to be 70 in May. Beautiful player. And they have Larry Light, young trombone player, good trombone player. So the band is now going to change a little bit because now they're getting into, sort of modern, but she just still sings her blues. But they're not going to get too modern. They're just going to get, just a tad more modern because I was playing an older school. I'm not what you call a Buddy DeFranco type clarinet player, but it's a good band and it's she's singing good. And
I have to agree with you that LaVey is singing good. I've heard a lot of singers in the Bay Area that I've not been very enthusiastic about, and I think she's an exception and a very tasteful singer.
Yeah, she really is. The last 6 months, the last 6 months she's been just singing her butt off. She really sounds good for what she's doing, you know. And of course, they're nice people.
Yeah.
Two of them that I work for, they're two of the nice people I ever worked for. Just beautiful people.
And of course, they can be heard, she can be heard Monday nights at Enrico's on Broadway in San Francisco.
Right, 504 Broadway and 2171. Anyway, it's Café du Nord on Upper Market Street.
What night is she at Café du Nord?
That's Saturday night.
Saturday night.
Yeah. And I must run on here. The problem, or did I say this already, that we, when we played these clubs, we got to play them six nights a week for a month. And then they gave us our notice, and we move on to another club. Or did I? Maybe I'm repeating myself.
No, this is an interesting point. You're saying that you used to play several nights a week, whereas now you're being booked once a week.
Yeah, once a week the man will let you play in his club, and then another band comes in, and I don't like this because I want to build up the audience for what I'm doing, and the Hangover Club was a perfect instance that we played. You know, we played in there three nights a week, and he didn't know what to do with himself, so he put us on five nights. Then the legal law union was six nights, and we played six nights a week. Then when he realized that he could make more money with stars, well, anyway.
By the way, just a bit ago, you tossed out the name Buddy DeFranco. Do you have a story about Buddy?
No, I took a lesson from him. One more freebies, Dave. I got to know him in 1945. We ended up playing, oh boy, this will never end. In 1945, no, strike that out. That's right. In 1945, we went and played 8 weeks in the Casino Gardens Ballroom. It was owned by Velas and Yolanda, the dancers. But by the time we got there, Tommy and Jimmy Dorsey bought it, although they weren't playing together then. They got together later. But also, a quick aside, Jimmy Dorsey also played on one of those clarinets that didn't have any keys on it.
Mm-hmm.
And he made his living as a young man playing for the Boswell sisters on those records that were made. They claimed they were made all after midnight. But anyway, we played opposite Jimmy's band, and then we played opposite Tommy's band. And that's where I met Buddy DeFranco. Now, Buddy and I were about 10 months apart. He wasn't very friendly, so we'll just pass that. He just wasn't very friendly. I knew about him. I had heard him play with Gene Krupa's band 9 months before in my kitchen, playing with Gene Krupa's band. They played a clarinet and drum duet. I got to get this all in. Anyway, then when he came to the Hangover, I went in there, and he was very friendly. And I said, I want to take a lesson. I said, I want you to watch me play. And he said, okay. This is my room number. This is my hotel. Come tomorrow, and I'll watch you. And for about a half hour, he pointed everything I did wrong, and I enjoyed it.
Do you have any other stories you can think of, just in general, about jazz in San Francisco?
Well,
fond memories, embarrassing moments.
embarrassing
brushes with royalty.
What about royalty?
Brushes with royalty?
No, I've never met King Hussein. He plays the saxophone, you know.
Well, I mean jazz royalty.
Oh, we play, little shortcuts here. We played a thing for Bob Scobia. He had a TV show, and he had Duke Ellington there. So, at the end of the gig, I said to Duke Ellington, where is Lawrence Brown? Because it was one of those periods where guys were leaving. I said to him, where is Lawrence Brown? And he says, he isn't with us anymore. You know, that's what he said.
Well, he was a very polite man.
Yeah, right. But anyway, that's the only thing I can recall that was kind of silly. I may go home and think of some things, but... Oh, I worked with Lizzie Miles. Lizzie, they had a place called the Tin Angel here in the early 60s. And it was known as the Tin Angel and then Earthquake Magoons.
Mm-hmm.
The first band, we had it when Peggy Tote Watkins had it. It was the Tin Angel. Then I think when Kid Ory got it, guys could correct me here, they called it Earthquake Magoons.
Ori would have been the Levy. You mean Turk?
All right. Earthquake Magoon. That's right. You're right. Absolutely right. How about that? That's right.
Turk started there when it was the
Earthquake
Tin Angel.
Earthquake Magoons. Where did Turk start that?
I'm not sure where the first location was. There's so darn many of them.
Yeah.
But he began at the Tin Angel.
Yeah. Turk Murphy. He built that bandstand. He built the bandstand. First, the bandstand was right by the door, and then they moved it to the other end.
Mm-hmm.
And he but when it was on this end near the door, I was working with Wally Rose. We made a record in 1955 called Cakewalk to Lindy Hop. These were all dances that Clancy Hayes sang. This was a Columbia record produced by George Avakian. And so we were playing, 1955, we were playing in this Tin Angel, and Lizzie Miles was working with us, and, you know, she sang in that, what do you call that, Creole?
Was that Creole? The Creole Patois?
Yeah. She sang some of her songs, and there were Jerry, the trombone player. I worked with Jerry quite a bit.
Jerry Butson?
Yeah. From 1951 to 1985, I did practically work with Jerry all of the time, yeah. And we thought she was swearing at us, but she was so heavy, and I don't know why I laugh at this, her feet would hit the bandstand, and each board would quiver, and we'd tell her, lose some weight, Lizzie, lose some weight, and she'd just giggle, and she could chew ice, and she'd come in the place, and we'd both sit together while I was getting my horn out, hiya Vince, hiya tonight, and she'd start chewing ice and drinking ice water. I'd start laughing, and neither of us knew what in the world we were laughing at, and we'd both just laugh 3 or 4 minutes, and then we both stop. These are just some of the things that I passed. And that woman was funnier than hell.
Now, you grew up in North Beach when it was still an Italian fishing colony.
Yeah, it was
fishing village, really.
Yeah, right. And it was kind of even considered a ghetto. You know,
mm-hmm.
They had all these kids running around, but the families didn't have. There was a truant officer. That's you didn't show up to school, and the truant officer came to your house the same day that you weren't there.
Was that an Irish truant officer?
I don't know. Anyway, they had that. Of course, by the time I was 12 years old, I was in the school over in Berkeley, mm-hmm. So I didn't have much to do with the streets of North Beach. I went to church there, the Catholic Church, for a few times.
I'm told your father was a fisherman.
My father and my two brothers were fishermen. My father fished on the what they call the boats that went out and caught sardines by the ton, and he was more or less instrumental to watch out where the schools of fish were.
Mm-hmm.
And by 1940, my father was spewing out to anybody who would listen, the sardines are going to finish. They're taking too many sardines out of the water. They finished.
Well, he was right about that, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah. He was. He was. You know, my father grew smarter as I grew older. One of those things that I think that's been said before.
That says a lot.
Yeah.
he worked on the sardine boats. Was he ever an independent fisherman?
Oh, yes. Then they had a 22-foot boat that he worked with nets. The nets had meshes, and they took in herring at this time of the year, the schools of herring, and sold it for $5 for 100 pounds or some he was making about $15 a week working 13, 20, 14, 15, 18 hours a day. He'd come in the house, eat, light that yellow corn cob pipe, pass out for 6-7 hours, and then get up and go back on that boat with either one of my brothers or one of his pals, you know, and they always split up, like I say, $15, $20 a week apiece, mm-hmm. and paid for the gas, those were gas putt-putt engines. And he never did go crabbing, where what you get the lines and you put them in the water, or the salmon fishing. He that was too much for him. But he supported us like that, and years later we realized we were being fed gourmet style, and we didn't know it as children.
Did he? How did he sell his fish to wholesalers or on the street retail?
Yes, he had a wholesaler that he did it all with, and except for Chinese and black and white men would come and stand by the boat, and they'd yell at him, you know, give me 10 pounds for 30 cents, give me to, because they'd take it to their stores. And he'd give them to them, you know. And then he'd tell them, he could hardly, you know, he'd just say, wait, you know, and he kind of motioned to them to stay where they were. And he'd lock the boat up, and they'd drive him home, which is 4 blocks from the wharf. And my dad would open the garage. And these guys would see these barrels, and boy, you know, out came the glasses, and those barrels had spigots. And there was, you know, barrel number one, barrel number two, and these guys would drink their wine with no food, because we drank our wine with food.
Mm-hmm.
But they drank glasses of wine, and then they had their fish in their trucks. Two or three trucks would be lined up along the Chestnut Street, and they'd all go to their various shops. So he had integration long before other people even thought of integration.
Uh-huh.
And they all loved it. Yeah.
What was it like on the street in those days? I mean, there must have been horse-drawn carts still, and...
Pardon me?
Were there horse-drawn carts on the streets?
Little. And by that time, like, I was born in 23, and I remember a horse at the peddler. He'd sell the fruit and vegetables, and he had a horse and wagon. The first initial guys that came with 100-pound sacks of onion or potatoes or tomatoes, they had horse and wagons, but then, you know, by 1935, they all had the heavy duty trucks, you know, big loud gas engines.
Yeah. Well, now the Italian restaurants in North Beach are now a big draw. That sort of family style of eating with the tureens of soup and
The one right down on Mason. I live on Chestnut. If you walk down to the other of the block, it would be Mason. If you cross the street, you'd pass the San Remo restaurant. I think it's called the San Remo Hotel. It's been there ever since I was born. I remember sitting on my front stairs at 6 o'clock at night, and you'd hear families, three children, all, you know, it was a family-oriented restaurant, and still is, but it doesn't do the volume it did then. And that volume went through the war, went through the 50s. Boy, you really got me... telling this is all truth. If anybody wants to verify it, play it for some other people my age, and they'll say,
Well, it's fascinating to hear from someone. You know, it's very interesting to hear from someone who was there.
Oh yeah. Well, another restaurant was called the Luca Restaurant, and that was on Powell and Francisco, I believe. That was a famous restaurant. Delmonico's was a famous restaurant. Fiori d'Italia was a famous restaurant. That's been going on for years, you know. And then Original Joe's in North Beach, or I think it was called New Joe's. There's where you got your first idea of eggs and vegetables and breadcrumbs and cheese and made into kind of a dry omelet.
Hmm.
That was the first omelet. But like I say, we never could afford to go to New Joe's.
Mm-hmm.
Just the girls that were making $15, $20 a week dancing or singing, and the musicians that were making $3, $4 a night in pay and $10 a night in tips, because they really had the rounders then, you know. The day of the rounder was really, really gone. But talk
about that a little. What do you mean by a rounder? You mean somebody on the TOBA circuit or?
No, a rounder is a customer that had a few things going on the side. You know what I mean? A couple of women going on the side.
Uh-huh. Or a gambler, maybe.
Gambler, and they were tremendous horse players. And they used to come in and just, drop $5 for any old thing, ace in the hole. By the time I got out of school, it was $5. Can you play Begin the Begin like Artie Shaw? Because, see, that record came out July of 38.
Uh-huh.
By January of 39, you know, he started making a lot of money. And according to Buddy DeFranco, as of 1950, Artie Shaw was still making $5,000 a year just off of Begin the Begin. That's 13, 12 years later, you know. But Buddy knew all the Buddy knew of the music business. He knows them. He's still alive. He knows the music business back and forth. Like, just like he knows that clarinet, you know.
I was interested in following a little more on what you were saying about the rounders.
The rounders kept all these musicians. Musicians really played rounders tunes. Lulu's Back in Town, Sonny Boy. These are late tunes. I'm in the 30s, but they had the Doll Dance, NOLA. All these things were 20s tunes. Sweet Lorraine, Sweet Lorraine is 1923. And the clarinet players, saxophone players, drummers, the trios were playing behind these singers or strippers. And they got a wage, but they also got tips. And as I understand it, they hauled off and split everything every night. That was a loyal thing between all the girls and the guys.
So the rounders were hustlers of one sort or another who made their money on the shady side of the law, but were big patrons of jazz music or a certain whatever their favorites were?
Sure, exactly that. Jazz was being played. We had a clarinet player. We had two clarinet players. Uncle and nephew, you know what I mean? And Frank Catalano, there were 11 Catalanos in the union at one time. But Frank was a real fine jazz clarinet player. Now, Frank would get into jam sessions with this famous man, Paul Desmond. And they'd get on clarinet, and Frank would, get him down, He'd kill him. But as soon as they got on alto, for some reason, Paul had that magic touch with the alto. But Paul also had the magic touch with the clarinet. Let's call it as it is. And then Frank's uncle, Leo, he was playing. I didn't know it was him, but I used to go fishing with my father when I could see him. This is really, you want to hear some more?
Keep going.
I used to go fishing with my dad in the summertime and just sort of hang around the boat. I could see enough to get around the boat. There was nothing to do at home, so my mother would say, 3 o'clock in the morning, take them fishing with you, get them out of the house. And I'd get suntan, So, I didn't do nothing at home but eat, and listen to the music on the radio. Like Chris says, you learn to play all that music on the radio. Well, anyway, this guy was playing clarinet by the tons and playing tenor. And I found out years later it was Leo playing in DiMaggio's. If you got off the boat, you'd walk across the street and you'd walk into this restaurant called DiMaggio's, mm-hmm. Joe DiMaggio's.
Mm-hmm.
And this was in the summer of 1939. Well, I met Frank and Leo about 3 years after that. They were the men that were advising me. They heard me play, and they advised me to get out of school a year earlier than I did.
Now, Leo, who was Leo again?
Leo was Frank's uncle, Leo Catalano.
Uh-huh.
He just passed away this last year. He was 80 years old. Yeah. He could also make you laugh. Laugh! I went to hear Art Van Damme. That was just real silly, but Leo was there too, because they all belonged to an accordion club. And Leo got to talking about the Mission District, you know. And Leo started imitating rabbit peddlers. They just sold rabbit in the 20s and early 30s.
This is when the Mission was an Italian, sort of working class and heavily Italian district also.
The whole city was really, really Italian, Chinese, and Irish, and French. I don't mean to get racial now, but it is a fact. And they did have their districts, but now they, you know, those districts out there, the Mission, there was Italian, and then they all intermingled, Chinese and Irish. I think the Knob Hill area, what do you call, there's another word for it, that had the more or less the French district. But in our district, in the Italian district, there was also the Francisco Junior High School. That's from the to the ninth grade, something like that. They had Chinese and Italian and black children all together.
Mm-hmm.
They all, that's it. It was no big thing to have it was just a stack of kids. Now, I guess, I don't know what they're all doing. They're all going nuts, but I shouldn't have said that, maybe.
Well, no, I'm just looking more for, you started to talk about, I'm just fascinated with this quality of life in San Francisco from a different era.
Well, the quality, well, you know, it was a hat and gloves and high heel type thing for women, you know. I mean, you know, the woman didn't go out on the street unless she, you know, was completely covered and dressed up. And the men never went out on the street unless they had their suit on practically. Everybody was, except for the plumber, you know.
Uh-huh.
And that was one of the things. As far as the culture, well, it was, it had its nightclubs. It had its tea dances. There was a man and his brother who did a big case, a murder case in Oakland. Well, before they did this murder case in Oakland, years before, they went to school, and on the side they were playing in the Palace Hotel on the weekends, tea dances, and the family name was Coakley, Tom and Frank Coakley. Tom Coakley, I think, was either Tom or Frank Coakley was the district attorney when they had the big murder thing, murder and kidnap in the late 50s, early 50s.
Uh-huh.
He put that case on, but I forget the it was involved. I forget the names. I'd say them, but the girl's name was Stephanie, but I forget the last.
Well, we're getting pretty far off the jazz.
Well, but I'm just trying to tell you that the city had all that.
Uh-huh.
You know, the city had music in the afternoons. The city had, in the 20s, you could tell the leader where to keep it and then go across the street and jump on the bandstand and you had another job. The musicians were just, they were all over. They had musicians. And, you know, all those theaters had at least five musicians playing in between the shows.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you knew that. Maybe I'm going far afield here.
Well, it reminds people of that there was a different... that there were different sorts of entertainments not that long ago.
No, not that long ago. And the entertainment, well, now they have the rock and roll groups or whatever groups they have. But as I say, these owners are not like the owners we worked for in that we could go in there and get a contract for 2 weeks. And if people started to come in, we were there for 6 weeks. And then the last 2 weeks, the seventh and eighth week, were on our notice. And we were out of a job, collect maybe 3 or 4 weeks, 5 weeks of unemployment, and go get another job. Now, these kids can't do that now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Vince, it's been a fascinating discussion. Vince Catolica, talking to you about some 50 years of involvement in jazz, swing, and Dixieland music.
Yes, well, I just say to myself, I've done my part, and I take it easy. I'm going to go home and try to go for a walk, and maybe by the time 6 o'clock I will have made some tomato sauce. I make my own tomato sauce. You know, I brown the onions, and I could go on and give you recipes on the next one.
Well, I've enjoyed hearing you around town and having the opportunity to record with you. It's too bad that there aren't more recordings, because you're a very wonderful player.
I've had my moments, like everybody else, and maybe my moments are more few, but I don't think I'll play again. No.
Well, Vince, I very much appreciate you coming in and sharing your memories with me and with the KLW listeners. And I want to thank you very much.
And thank you for having me, Dave.
Thanks again, Vince.
Very much.
Have a good evening.